Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by the 2013 Hyundai Sonata. Learn more at HyundaiSonata.com. Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
This is Autoline After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 167 for September 28th, 2012. Another Night Not in Paris.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Well, hello, everybody. This is another interesting episode of Autoline After Hours. I have Gary Vassilash with me from Automotive Design and Production. And Auto Field Guy, Gary.
How Peter, are you? How are you? I'm doing great.
Good. And Jim Hall is phoning in, and he has to turn his sound off on his computer because we're getting backup.
My sound is off.
Oh, well, something's not quite right, Ben. Anyway, we're getting backsplash. Jim is here in spirit, but he's on the phone because there was a communication issue. So, Jim, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
Jim Hall from 2953 Analytics. And let's get going. But before we do, I need to say something. Mr. McElroy had a very interesting show today. And he, from Paris, the dog. And they did a nice live webcast today, and we're going to talk about some of the cool cars from that show tonight. But you can check out the special webcast John did earlier today from the floor of the show at autoline.tv. He talked to our pal Johan Denyshin at Infiniti and Detlev von Platen about the Panamera wagon concept, which is shockingly good looking. And yeah, they sure did, Jim. You know, it's very strange. The three-quarter front of the car is transformed.
Yes.
The three-quarter front view. We have it on the screen right now. It's just, it really caught me off guard. It was unexpectedly so. What's your take on it?
Well, it's interesting because they've done a lot on the car. It's not just a roofline. I mean, you call it, the nose is spectacular. They got a lighting system in it using white LEDs and these quad ellipses that's spectacular. They even want to resurface the side of the car, the fender and the front door. And they've given the car a lot more form. I'll tell you the truth, I think they need to build this in addition to the Panamera. And you do this as a facelift for the Panamera because it's spectacular.
So you're saying they should just replace the Panamera sedan with this?
No, I think we should supplement it initially, to tell you the truth, because this thing, while it's a neat-looking shape, let's face it, Peter, it's not a Porsche form.
No, it isn't.
And, you know, a properly done Panamera, where you drop that rear the rear header down about 2 inches, is going to start looking like a Porsche.
Doesn't it almost look as though and it wouldn't look like a Porsche if they did that, but if you had the rear shoulder was there was more form
more pronounced
to it. Yeah,
well, actually, when you hand wash a Panamera, that rear shoulder is more pronounced than you think. It doesn't show up in some paint jobs like black, for instance. Mm-hmm. But if you have the right metallic, it shows up, and when you're driving it and you look out the side mirrors, you get a very definite feel for the bulge rear fenders. But you know, Jim, we also know that they're going to do a short wheelbase Panamera coupe. So I guess
the GT, yep.
Yeah, which should be spectacular. But so I guess this wagon has a place. I mean, they made it clear that it's going to be in addition to the Panamera lineup. So,
and the truth is, proliferating vehicles in the Panamera lineup is one way to keep the volumes up as the car ages, but takes care of the normal decay rate. So I think it's probably a good way to keep the plant running, because as you know, it's a hot car for them.
Yeah, but the only thing I think you and I agree on, and Gary, I don't know if you know this, but they are talking around the fact of doing a Panamera Junior.
I didn't know that.
Which I think is a big mistake.
It's a huge mistake.
So hopefully,
so what would be the point?
I don't really know. Hopefully they will lose interest in that, because, you know, it'll be, what, 2 years before this car is out?
Yeah, maybe it could be a tad before, because they've been working on this for a while.
And then it would be the coupe. It would be the next big thing that they have.
I think the discussion about the Panamera, the small Panamera, all came about in the idea that, look, this thing is selling like hotcakes. Let's do something else. And I think it might have been a little bit of the Volkswagen thing, throw the pasta on the wall, whatever sticks we'll go with. But they really don't need it in the Porsche product range, the small car. This thing, they've got room for.
Well, isn't the point of this that it is a large version of the Porsche, and they have smaller ones that exist already? So why not?
Well, there's kind of a clear dichotomy going on. There's the Porsche sports cars, and then there's the Porsche, I don't know what.
They're the Porsche family cars, Peter. They really are.
Yeah, there's the Porsche sedan, now the Porsche sport wagon, the Porsche, Cayenne, the SUV. So, yeah, there's a clear split going on, which is interesting.
So to take the large one and make it a small one seems to make little sense at all, because basically I think part of the popularity of the large one is predicated on the fact that it is a large one.
Yeah, I agree with you. I know Jim does too. We were talking about that the last time we were here, and we just that has disaster written all over it. Jim, what else did you like from Paris? I hate talking about car shows from a distance. First of all, when you're there, there's a couple things going on. First of all, the Paris show is the best show, hands down. Secondly, we also know when you walk around these shows and see these vehicles under the lights, you really still don't have any idea how they really look until they're out in the road. So that's
exactly.
That's kind of a liability for us to talk about it, but Ben has some visual support, so maybe we can talk about a couple of things. We do know that Maserati is going to call their SUV version of the, based on the Jeep platform, the Levante.
And build it in Detroit.
I don't know. I just don't know about that.
Well, I mean, this allows, the capacity at Jefferson North to be increased.
I know all the financial aspects of it, but will they have as much success as Porsche had with the Cayenne? I don't know. First of all,
for one thing, Peter, they don't have the dealer network.
Yeah,
so
I was just going to
keep them.
I was just going to say that, Jim. They don't have the dealer network. So what? I don't get it. But
I understand part of it is they want the product, so they have a range to expand the dealer network in North America, which arguably they should be doing. I mean, let's face it, of the traditional Italian exotic nameplates, Maserati has always been, has been for the longest time the most prosaic. They had a sedan when nobody else did, and they did those strange Japanese compact cars when they did the B-turbos, remember? The total un-Maseratis.
Yeah, those are disastrous. The only thing more disastrous was the Maserati TC.
Oh gosh, yeah, okay, that's getting pretty bad.
Yeah, does that count though?
I should read.
It was the TC by Maserati.
Yeah, it was. But yeah. Was it the Chrysler TC by Maserati, or was it just the TC by Maserati? Either way,
Maserati.
Yeah, it was a disaster.
But, my question is, at what point do you run out of gas in those cars?
And nobody's going to see it, Peter, and say, oh, that's a Grand Cherokee. They've done a transformative job.
Oh, no, I know that. I know that. It's just the liability is the dealer network. What were you going to say? Here?
Well, I was going to say that, okay, you want to extend your range. You want to have more product in your dealership. But at what point is there saturation in that type of vehicle at all levels in the market?
Well, yeah. I mean, it goes back to how many dealers are there. And, yeah, you're saying that does the luxury market really need that SUV? Well, apparently Bentley's going to do one.
Right.
So I don't know. There's got to be a limit somewhere. But, you know, and I admit I was one of the biggest critics of Porsche, but, you know, damn if they didn't pull the Cayenne off, and damn if the profits didn't get plowed back into doing, you know, the Cayman, the Boxster, the new 911, and all of that. So I don't think it's going to work that way for Maserati, though. They just don't have the throwaway. So it's kind of going to... They have to be careful that it doesn't turn into an oddity, which is, you know, very possible. I don't know. I don't care how cool it is. Then the other news from Maserati is they're going to come out with a smaller sedan call it the Ghibli. Now, I haven't seen that. Have you, Jim? I haven't. They haven't shown it.
No, I haven't seen it. And you can see where the product fits. What they're trying to do is create a bridge between where they think they're going to have Alfa Romeo and Maserati. And it means moving the Maserati nameplate down market a little bit from where it is right now.
Is that a volume play?
Yeah, but remember, we're talking about a company whose volumes are very, very small to begin with. So it doesn't take much to give you a 100% increase.
Yeah. What about the Peugeot Onyx? John had it on the webcast today, and boy, is it slick looking. Did you see it, Jim?
Yeah, I have. It's slick looking, and it's also a festival of unusual materials. It's even using things like recycled paper in it. But, you know, it's interesting. They do this sort of wild performance diesel car after they get out of Le Mans with a wild performance diesel car. I don't understand the timing.
Yeah, I don't either. I think they've been sitting on this car for maybe longer than they admit to. The juxtaposition of the copper finish with the flat carbon was just sensational. But, you know, let's face it. We're talking about a car company in deep trouble. They pull out of their Le Mans program with literally maybe 90 days of warning to the people involved. You know, this car is cool, but in the end, so what? You know, they're embroiled with the GM thing and trying to make sense of that. So it's very cool, but it just might be one of these design cars that, you know, sound and fury, much sound and fury signifying nothing.
Well, it makes me wonder.
It almost reminded me of the Maserati, or excuse me, the Freudian slip. It almost reminded me of the Chrysler ME412 at the Detroit show, when Chrysler is actually tanking and they show a mid-engine 12-cylinder sports car.
Yeah, and, you know, they even flew journalists out to Laguna Seca to, you know, to give them rides and all that. I knew Wolfgang quite well, and that was, you know, they were really excited about it, but it was just like, exactly, what is this for? It's going nowhere.
Yep.
So, Gary, what'd you think of the new Golf? Yet another, you know, every time I look at the Golf and I drive one, I come away impressed, and I just say, what can they possibly do to it? And here they are with the seventh generation.
Well, you know, it seems to me that they have a very clear understanding of what they're trying to accomplish with that car. And that they have, you know, this you know, I hate to use the term laser-like focus, and presumably a team of people who are dedicated to advancing it without throwing it away. So you're having this sense of incremental improvement. And, I mean, how do they do that? I mean, you just look at every other car company that maybe they'll have a run of maybe three, possibly four, and then they lose it, yeah. Right? And these guys have just soldiered on and on and on and on.
Yeah, the continuity is impressive, and the detail improvement. And, you know, yeah, it's grown each time, but when you drive it and the fit and finish and the executional details, pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Jim?
Well, my concern about it is you're right. Every Golf is better than the predecessor in a lot of qualitative and quantitative ways. I just wish that at least once they'd push the design button and make a progressive change, and they still haven't done that.
Yeah, exactly. What about the Opel Atom? Again, I've only seen a picture of it. What do you think of it, Jim?
The Atom's really interesting because they see it as a take for a personality price premium B car that they can sell, like the Fiat Cinquecento and the Mini, and it's got a lot of character for doing that. They're also going to be launching it with a new engine family. I think the thing has some merit. The problem is it's saddled with the Opel name in Germany, and that's not a good thing right now.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, the white wheels are such a turnoff for me, but whatever.
Well, see, the thing that I wonder about it is that, you know, they're really looking for getting some profitability into Opel. And I just wonder whether sufficient profitability can be achieved by a car in that category. Well, I mean, you're going to have to sell zillions of the damn things.
I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. What are they going to make? Like, you know, $1.98 on it?
Yeah.
I don't know, to be competitive. I love the McLaren P1, of course. McLaren, well, before we do that, hey, you know what, Ben? We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the new McLaren. But, Ben, let's hear from our friends at Hyundai.
You know why I pulled you over, ma'am? I need you to recalibrate the Doppler shift on the return signal. Radar's on the frisk.
Do Sonata drivers know something you don't? The Sonata from Hyundai.
Pretty good. Like that.
Wow.
So, you know, I think most of our viewers and listeners are aware of the McLaren F1, which to date is probably still the greatest supercar ever built. I mean, I don't know what the Veyron is. It's just like this thing. But the F1 is still, to me, the state of the art. And now McLaren has showed up at the Paris Motor Show with the P1, which, it looks spectacular. It's forward-thinking. It's everything they know so far. And it's wild.
I have to disagree about the styling.
I was
trying to figure out what cliche it's missing.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. The only place where the styling is surprising is the back.
What does surprising mean?
It's just the feel of it from the back. It's just...
So you think too much is going on back there and that whale tail doesn't seem to be quite
yeah,
appropriate?
Yeah, I mean, I think the specifications of the car, I mean, it's going to have to be dramatically better in performance than the 12C, which, you know, if somebody, you know, forgot and left a 12C for me, I'd be perfectly happy. I think the P1, technically, I'm sure, is spectacular, but, the looks of it are certainly not friendly.
I think it's a classic. In a way, it's sort of like a very expensive Subaru BRZ or Scion FRS, a really spectacular car in its own way that needs to be reskinned right away.
Yeah.
It almost looks like they carved out the sides and said, gee, what are we going to do with this extra material? Oh, I know. Let's put it in the back.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what their timetable for production or anything like that, but I'm excited about it, but then the longer you spend looking at it, it's kind of scary, actually.
So, Peter, do you think that McLaren will be able to establish itself as a car company?
Yes, I do, but I think actually they're the only car maker with the stones to go after Ferrari and actually might be able to get there. But I also think they don't have any illusions about it. I think they think it's going to take a while. But, you know, comparing the 458 Italian, the 12C, I mean, the 12C perfectly encapsulates McLaren for some reason. I mean, it's coldly calculating, precise. It does what it's supposed to do, but it's almost completely devoid of emotion, whereas the Italia is all about that. It's precise and fast and all that, but it's emotionally compelling.
Well, it's more about the gesture.
Yeah. What do you think, Jim? Do you think McLaren has a shot?
Well, they have a shot, but they're going to be making effectively passionless supercars that do everything very, very well. And the question is whether there's a market for passionless supercars in the same kind of quantities that Ferrari sells. Because on a global basis, for the price of their vehicles, they do pretty darn well in a good year.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got a good look at a 12C in McLaren Orange a couple of times this year, and I love the car for different reasons than the Italia. I mean, I could, like I say, if someone forgot and, you know, left one for me by mistake, I would be happy. But
Peter, if you could have one and that was to be your car, it put the way you want, which would you pick, an Italia or a 12C?
Well, I've never owned a Ferrari or even gotten close to owning a Ferrari, so that would be a tough one. The only thing about it is Ferrari is dangling on the edge of almost not jumping the shark by any means. It's still a great car company, builds spectacular cars. But their push into emerging markets is almost too much for me. And I might err to the McLaren because you just don't see them as much. But, you know, obviously Italia would be great. Are you kidding?
But, I mean, isn't a lot of that, though, about, you know, Ferrari has historic resonance, that it stands for something that you know and understand and appreciate, and there's passion and there's excitement and there's drama and so on. And you look at McLaren, on the other hand, and it is a comparatively new company. I mean, even if we go back to the, you know, the entire history of their F1
days. Well, K&M, really.
And that they're basically, you know, if, you know, Jim's term of passionless supercar, I mean, I would look at it from the point of view of a technological tour de force, that these guys are crack engineers who are going at every gram of that vehicle and make sure that it plays just right. And as a result of that, I mean, the nature of the two companies is so vastly different that the products they make can only be different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I applaud for McLaren for doing it. I mean, you know, if anybody technically is capable of doing it, they are. And I understand that you've been to the facility, and I've talked to prospective owners who have been to the facility, and they say you go to the facility and you want to buy one.
Oh, it's just unbelievable. Jim, it reminds me of a lair of a Bond villain. It's just great.
Well, that's
absolutely
right.
Absolutely, yeah, you're right. You're talking about the MP12 facility or just the McLaren headquarters in general is like that?
Well, because the MP412 facility is connected by an underground passageway. So, I mean, it's the whole thing. I mean, everything's going on there that you're just waiting to see Blofeld walk out.
No, he's there. His name is Ron Dennis.
Hey, Jim, we're going to talk about two more cars. The first is the Jaguar F-Type. Again, I have not seen the car in person, and I really want to see one on the street before I pronounce judgment. I mean, it looks pretty interesting, but, you know, I don't know. I'm afraid it's not that interesting to me, and I want to reserve final judgment, but it just doesn't seem to get there. Now, the one thing I'm missing is the presence, the physical size of it. I'd have to see that, but I'm not jacked up about it. How about you, Jim?
No, I wanted a car that blew me away when I saw it. And the thing is, it's attractive. It's got a face on it, which a lot of sports cars don't have. Maybe too much face for some people. But the surfacing on it, it's, in some ways, there are aspects of it that is a very predictable car. And I was expecting them to push a little farther than they did. Again, seeing it in person is going to make a difference, and I suspect dynamics are going to be a big issue with it as well.
But I got to tell you, if I had the extra cash, it makes the Ferrari California look sensational.
Well, yeah, but it's a lot cheaper than the California, too. Remember, we're talking about a car here that I think is going to be mid-range Boxster money.
Yeah, no, I understand. You'd have to pay $100,000 more for California, but wow, does it make the California look all of a sudden really great? Although they've improved the California quite a bit, they've kind of snuck in a heavy revision to it, dynamically and everything else, but you still can't quite fix that tail. So
no.
Again, if someone dropped one off and forgot about it, I would be, you know.
Would this be the California or the F-Type or both?
The California.
So if they dropped off the F-Type, you just
F-Type, I'd send it over to your house.
Okay, thank you.
So the last car we're going to talk about, and Gary's been nice enough to assemble a lot of the details of it, is the Mercedes-Benz SLS Electric, which they unveiled at the Paris show. And the specs on this thing is just mind-boggling. Gary, can you give us a little, some of the high-hard ones about it?
So here we have four electric motors. So they are using wheel motors on this, and it's a total output of 552 kilowatts, a maximum torque of 1,000 newton meters, 0 to 62 in 3.9 seconds. This is
20-hour battery recharge time from minimum state of charge.
Is that what they said?
Yeah, unless you have.
I thought they said something about a fast charge.
Well, if you have the Super Juice connection, it's like 3 hours.
I thought it was
something like that. I thought I read that, but and what did they say the range was?
Range 250 kilometers, so that's what, roughly 125 miles.
Well, I have to believe that is if you're driving with an egg between your foot and the accelerator at 50 miles an hour. If you go hammer the thing, you're probably out of juice in about 40 miles, right, Jim? I mean, it's.
Four motors, it's tough to imagine that thing getting a lot of range with 400 dragons.
Now you were breaking up, Jim. What'd you say?
It's hard to imagine any kind of range when you're hammering the car. I mean, seriously, you're driving four electric motors, making a bunch of kilowatts, so you'd be taking the battery down pretty darn fast, I think.
Yeah, and you were right about the charging time, blah, blah, blah. Ideally charged with the, like this, so-called wall box. Installed in a home garage, this technology provides 22 kilowatt of quick charge function, which is the same as charging the performance available under a public charging station, blah, 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 blah. Charging in around 3 hours. Without the wall box, charging takes around 20 hours.
And how much is it? $550,000 US?
Yeah, it's, where is that figure?
And it's more than twice as much as the regular car.
That's 416,500 euros, or at today's exchange rate, $538,300, or 41.77 million yen.
You know, I don't know if there's a market for this, but I'd rather have a regular SLS, frankly. But
can't you imagine being a rich guy who would have one of these things and his friends could come over and say, I have one of these things?
Oh, yeah, especially in Silicon Valley. This is my mean green machine, and I'm cool. And, okay, once that's done, once 30 of those people are done, then what? I don't know what Mercedes is going
to
do.
So you really took it to Mr. Fisker this week, speaking of
we're going to get to that. We're not done with the Paris show, because we're going to talk about Sergio, you know, challenging Ferdinand Piëch to a duel on the show floor or something. But we're going to talk about that after Ben shares with us hearing from our friends from Bridgestone. So, Jim, I'm sure you heard about Sergio just going off on... Well, first of all, for background for our listeners and viewers, Sergio Marchionne and Ferdinand Piëch have been basically at war with each other because Ferdinand, you know, the mad genius that runs the Volkswagen Group, thinks the world would be a lot better if he controlled Alfa Romeo, and he took it off Sergio's hands because they clearly have, you know, wasted years of stewardship of it. And, you know, he will be glad to take it off his hands, you know, shortly. And the more they go at it, the more pissed off Sergio gets. The latest thing is Volkswagen Group went off and said they want Sergio removed from some...
the lobby group, ACEA.
Yeah, the European Automotive Lobby Group.
Yeah.
And so Sergio today at the show said, I guess there's a meeting at the Volkswagen stand of that group, and Volkswagen wants Sergio removed. So Sergio said, well, they can meet me at 7 a.m. at the... I'll meet them at the stand, and, you know, there's going to be some sort of throwdown. So I don't know. Seeing as Sergio has based his whole future on turning Alfa into all of a sudden an accepted global brand, which is a tall order, I might add, this is just going to continue to be a standoff, I would imagine. Right, Jim?
I suspect. But you're also going to see that the more Piëch wants Alfa, the more they're going to strategically figure out what they need to do with Alfa. And that's why they've approved a rear-wheel drive vehicle platform. So I think we're going to get better Alphas out of this. And it's almost like the more Piëch says it, the more Sergio just says, we're going to make Alfa work. And maybe that's part of Piëch's strategy, that they'll put a lot of money in trying to make Alfa work. I don't know.
Well, you know, Sergio has a very tall order because he's gone on the record not once, not twice, but I would guess 100 times saying that by 2014-2015 time frame, Alfa's going to be happening. Well, you know, they got a long way to go. I don't care how good the integrity of the cars are.
2 years?
Yeah, they're nowhere. And you know, we've talked on this show and the Sunday show about how difficult it is to launch a brand in this market. And make no mistake, that's what they're doing with Alfa, because it has no residual cred with anyone but pure driving enthusiasts who, you know, still enjoy the brand. Everyone else remembers it in The Graduate. You know, that's kind of a tough way to go. So he's talking not only the commitment in engineering resources and product development and all of that, he's talking probably a $500 million marketing bill over the next 5 years to get this thing seated in the American consumer consciousness. It's a tough road. And, you know, the jabs from Piëch are classic because he's basically saying, you know, Sergio, just give it up. You know, we'll take it off your hands, you know. And
well,
and then our long national nightmare will be over. So,
but, I mean, to your point of the investment, I mean, so according to Bloomberg, Fiat's supposed to lose 700 million euros this year and has cut back spending, investment spending, by 500 million euro this year.
Well,
so,
yeah.
So where's the money going to come from to create this?
Well, the profits from the
U.S.
Yeah, the profits from the U.S. But the other dimension to this is now Sergio has huge political problems in Italy. And, you know, those are nothing to be sneezed at, because that could derail everything too. But right now, Sergio's plan is, I'm going to make money hand over fist in the U.S., and that will pay for everything. You know, that's worked so far.
But if he takes his attention off Chrysler, and Chrysler's doing incredibly well now, right, because somebody has been paying attention to that brand and making sure that the products are up to snuff, and if he takes his eye off that ball and says, okay, we're gonna do this stuff with Alfa, then where does that get you?
Well, this is something.
Gary,
go ahead, Jim.
Gary, the man is a multitasker. Trust me, it's not pay attention to one or the other. The whole thing with Fiat is, as you know, he said he doesn't see how you can make money building cars in Italy, which got him really in good with some of the politicians there and the unions. But he's probably telling the truth. You know, I mean, it's got to be tough. And if they have to use the U.S. for their profit to do Alfa, and if they get out of it platforms they'll be able to use at Alfa at Maserati and at Chrysler Group vehicles, you know, so be it. And I think you're going to see a lot of development on that platform. I know it's being done in the States. So I don't write them off that. I mean, the big issue is spending the marketing money to set the brand in the North American market because, I mean, Peter's absolutely right. The public at large don't know Alfa. And the problem is in Europe right now, you know, Alfa sells two new cars that they're building, the Giulietta and the Mito, nothing else. That's their range.
Yeah.
And so we have the Dart, which is the Giulietta.
Yep.
And so what would comparable to the Mito be?
Well, for the States, we probably won't get it because remember the Mito is actually a size down from where they want to try to play. But Alfa is about doing a larger front drive sedan that'll probably be derived from this the thing I call the Mid-Atlantic platform. That's the development of their CD car. And then a rear drive, larger Alfa sedan, a rear drive, you know, there's gonna be a Miata platform derived Alfa, and then a more expensive sports car. So I mean there's their range for the US and logically they need a crossover.
Well, we wish them luck. A lot of good people work out in Auburn Hills, but one thing I will reiterate, and I've hammered it repeatedly, is that Sergio has set up a management structure that ends with him. When he leaves that company, there is no one else who can do it his way. So unless there's a transformation when he's ready to get out and they have a reporting structure that's other than that the CEO has 37 direct reports, you know, I don't know. It's a dangerous future for that whole deal. Let's move on. A couple of people are kind of in trouble that are dining on the trough of our money. One is Henrik Fisker, and the other is Elon Musk, who I have to give the guy credit with his space things and all the accomplishments there. But as one of my readers pointed out, he's finding out that, hey, this auto stuff's pretty complicated. You know, I can do the space stuff, but, you know, you can't just, you just can't phone it in the auto business. And so the Model S is delayed. They have to sell more stock. I mean, this thing is teetering.
Yeah, but they have the supercharger now.
Oh, well, yeah, that's it. And, but I did my column this week on Henrik Fisker, and this thing looks like it's about to come undone. As I referred to Henrik, I just lost my thing here. I got to get it. Talk amongst yourselves. Hey, Jim, what do you think of Musk and Tesla?
Well, you've got two different things going on. With Musk, you actually have a fully developed vehicle. Over the last weekend, I spent a fair amount of time driving Model S's and some other vehicles. And compared to driving the Tesla the Fisker I drove last year, the Fisker was a totally undeveloped, loose car. The Model S is a real automobile that's obviously a work in progress. A couple of us sat down after we spent our time in the cars and we did a walkthrough on what the car must be costing them. And we think if they're lucky, they're making 20 grand a car. Do the math. That means if they sell 20,000 cars, not enough money to run a car company for a year.
You said they're making 20 grand a car?
That's estimated.
Let me explain. We did a thing looking at the signature and assuming they're going to do predominantly high-content cars. And we did a walk-down where we broke down the systems in the car. And some of it is magic hand-waving, we have to admit, because we don't know what the battery pack costs. But they could be making as much as 20 grand a car. On an allocated basis. This is basically on a piece cost basis. It's core variable cost. And what it means is that they'd be lucky to get $400 million. Lucky to get $400 million, because when you take burden in it, you're probably looking more at $120 million from the sale of cars. That's not enough to run a car company.
No, it's not, because you're talking to develop a new car is minimum $1 billion. More likely, they might be able to do that for less, Peter.
They actually might be able to do it for less because they don't carry as much burden and so on, and they can leverage some of their suppliers. But generally speaking, it's not enough to keep a car company going.
Yeah. So that's that. That's Tesla. But as I referred to Fisker, Fisker's rolling note to self, the karma. I mean, I think this is this project is imploding. And, you know, as a design statement, when you first look at it, oh, it's kind of cool, but it's not really, it's, you know, it's using Bolt technology, basically. And
it's got the Ecotec engine in it. I mean, it's Volt technology.
It is Volt. It's
no, the Volt technology is more sophisticated.
Yeah, it's more sophisticated and it works.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Fisker, you know, was gifted the government money, and now they've withheld half of it. He's scrambling. I think they just announced they scraped up another $100 million from private investors, and I gotta say, really? You people out there with that kind of money, handing that money over to Henrik, I don't get it. Jim, you've been around the car. I've seen the car. I've not driven it, but it didn't help this week that Consumer Reports basically said it was not ready for prime time on any level. And
it's not, Peter. It's like driving, you know, remember the Chrysler 300 concept car they built off of the Viper component set?
Yes.
It's like driving that, where they let the media and they let people drive it and say, now, don't go over 40. The Fisker starts to unravel the faster you drive it. And it has things like these capacitive door switches that, as I was driving it around a handling course, I put my hand on the armrest for a minute. And the corner of my hand hit the capacitive door thing, and there's no lockup. The door opened up at 70. You know, and it's a car that looks like a caricature. It's got a lot of style in it, but very little finesse. And I have a feeling it's a car that was built with no vehicle development. Not only that, you know that the deal it's done is a black box car. They're built for Fisker by Valmet in Finland.
Yes.
And that seems to fly completely in the face of the Category 136 federal money.
Yeah, but that has not been.
But wasn't that for the Wilmington plant?
Oh, yeah, that was the Biden deal.
But the Wilmington plant is for the next car.
For the Nina.
Yeah, the Nina and then the Pinta
Santa,
and
the Santa Maria.
Yeah. Well, like I said in my column, I don't think they're going to make it. I think they've had the 15 minutes of attention from this business that they warranted, but now everybody's done with it.
But isn't it possible that this was all a play to get purchased by someone?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I'll tell you why. Because, one, if you were going to do that, you'd want to have a closer partnership with at least one large car manufacturer. And, two, you probably wouldn't farm out the production to an outside source. I think this is a case where they went around, they had an idea, they had a lot of VC money that thought, yeah, we'll take this money and change the world. I remember the Fisker guys telling them how they were going to show the car how to rewrite the business. You know, and who did they use? The people who used to build Saab convertibles for General Motors.
The Boxster was built by Valmet.
Initially, yes.
Well, yeah.
So they didn't pick bad people to make it. Let's just put it that way.
Well, so if Tesla has a developed car or they understand vehicle development, but that's still not going to get them over the hump, and Fisker does not have a developed car, and he's basically been scrounging around using other people's money to bring his boyhood sketches to life, and it's not going to end well. On that note,
I don't think so.
Now, on that note, we're going to take another break here and hear from our friends at Chevrolet.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
All right, we've reached that time in the program where we take viewer questions. Hopefully they're brief and to the point. Ben, let's roll that rapid-fire video gig. All right, Jim, you ready? Gary, you ready? Here we go.
Ready.
Michael Schenken asks, can you shed any optimism on Volkswagen importing or producing the Amarok here in the U.S.? The fuel mileage and rugged design are exactly what I'm looking for, hoping for some good news. No, they're not. Okay. Unless Jim knows something I don't know. A.M. Guerrero, why is it that over a decade ago, car makers were able to make sedans that are as low as today's four-door coupes, but still have decent headroom. I don't know if that's necessarily true.
I think she was shorter then. You know, the woman's gotten taller.
Brian asks, what are the misses of the Paris show? That Audi Crosslane concept, which mimics Audi's own Steppenwolf concept of 2000?
I thought it looked a lot like the A3. I mean, it didn't seem to be much of an advance to me.
Yeah, I didn't get it at all. I mean, it did introduce a little different nose treatment. Jim, did you see that car?
Yeah, I saw the Crosslane. I have a feeling we're talking about, like the Steppenwolf, cross-pollinating a couple of vehicle types, and at the same time, Walter's throwing some new design cues in that they're sort of getting as a trial balloon to see what people think of them.
Right. See, I just read that as possibly Audi using that as a test bed to begin to use more carbon fiber in their products rather than anything else, because you notice that before they were talking about combining aluminum, which they had the expertise in, with steel, you know, ultra-high-strength steel, and doing that for cost purposes. But now they're going like, well, let's use carbon fiber, you know, carbon fiber-reinforced plastics.
Yeah.
And so more of a technology play than anything else.
Yeah, well, there is – the nose does introduce a different look for the Audi classic front end.
It uses an intersecting form to set up the grill.
Right.
And I suspect you're going to see that on a future Audi car.
Yes, that's the whole purpose of that concept, is to introduce that front end.
You think?
Yeah. And on Q, Mitch W. asks, what's with all the enormous front grills on cars today, particularly luxury cars? Chinese taste for status displays? Well, from where I come from on this, you know, there has to be a presence on the road for these makes. There has to be a distinctive look and feel. Now, Audi has pioneered this more than any other brand, in my estimation, and you're seeing car companies trying to get at that. They have to have a design signature. And I think the latest attempt at that is the new Lexus front design language, which looks like it's hung on a car that it doesn't go with.
The spindle grill.
Yeah. I assume they will get to the point where it actually looks good.
Well, the concept car they had at Paris is pretty interesting. It's a new take on the spindle, and personally, I think it works pretty well.
I agree.
Telegraphing. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
The car is telegraphing a lot of the design language that's going to be on the 2013 IS.
I agree with you. That concept really gives me a little bit of hope that they're going to pull it off. But when you see it on the... what is it, the 450? It looks like...
No, the 460.
Yeah.
It doesn't work on that car. They did not pull it off well.
Yeah, it looks like they went to a body shop and cut off the nose and welded something on just to say, hey, look at our new front end.
But you know what's interesting you think about grills is that when the first generation Taurus came out, remember everybody thought that car wouldn't work because it basically didn't have
a grill.
And so that was the look. No grill.
Yeah, Ben put the concept up on the screen, Jim, that, you know, it works there.
Yeah.
They did the side sculpting, everything about it. So,
well, part of it is it's less symmetrical than the ones that they're using on the production vehicles. And so you have right. more planted down direction.
Yeah, Mitch W. also asks, who finances McLaren? I don't see how such a small company does this without a big backer in the background. McLaren has deep pockets.
And they have a lot of investment from deeper
Saudi
pockets.
Arabia. And they're connected. Remember, the connection with TAG is a capital one.
Yes. Yes. When they won the Formula One championship, it was the TAG McLaren Honda.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Glenn E. asks, will the Dakota return in some form? I suspect Chrysler is going to... actually, they hinted at that last week, that they were looking at the midsize truck market. I don't know what the midsize truck market is anymore. I do know that, to me, a compact pickup would probably make more sense than a midsize. So I'm not a trucker.
I would think we're going to see a compact before we see.
Yeah, I'm not a trucker, so I don't know. Okay, S2000 Moose on Twitter asks, If U.S. sold its GM shares, how much positive effect would that have on sales? Really? Would that positive effect make up for tanking stock? Well, that's all about GM is desperate to get out from under the moniker of Government Motors. They don't want that connection to be have anything to do with the company. So whatever the financial ramifications are, they believe that it's worth it, and I tend to agree with them.
See, but I just wonder whether, you know, once painted with a brush, whether that stain is going to come off.
Well, not overnight, and, you know, people may never forget it. But, you know, really, I do know that they're having trouble alluring executives there because they're not being able to pay, so something's got to give. I think as soon as the election's over, no matter who wins, the government sells. It might not be all at once, but over the winter months into early spring, they'll be out. Okay, Ron Paris asks, am I the only one that thought the 1995 destination charge for a new Viper a bit excessive? Did they wrap these things in protective gold foil wrap to account for double the freight costs of any other car? Yes, matter of fact, they do. No, I don't know why. The Viper plant's cool. It's right in Detroit and
Connor Avenue.
I don't know. I think they're just trying to make some money.
Yeah, I think it's the same reason that dogs lick themselves or something like that.
Yep. Thank you for that analysis, Jim. All right. Let's see. Frank from Bridgeton, New Jersey asks, will the European Toyota Auris come stateside as the new Corolla? Also, when will Toyota build a sporty hybrid? Not the Lexus GS. No, the Lexus GS does not count. It's too expensive. I don't know. I assume the Auris is another hint of the future design language of the smaller Toyotas. I think that's a given. As far as the sporty hybrid, I don't know.
Well, I mean, they're obviously expanding the Prius lineup, and they're going to continue down that path. And, you know, you'd say, well, you know, they have that platform they're using for the FRS, which is not used for anything else than the Scion, so.
Yeah. What do you think, Jim?
Well, to take them in order, the Auris we're not going to see in the States. They've sort of established what they want the next Corolla to be for the States and for big chunks of the world, and it's apparently attractive but not progressive. And as far as sporty hybrids go, their hybrid philosophy now is enhanced performance. They make a big deal out of the fact that it's a solid 200 horsepower Camry, but they're looking more power than just performance in the traditional sense. They could do one, and at one time, apparently, they went to some Italian coach builders just to get an idea of what it would take to build a Prius sport coupe, and I think the program died, to tell you the truth. Okay. It was about 2 years ago. It was going along. And apparently, they had some interesting proposals sent to them, and they dropped it.
Okay. Am Guerrero did a little research on Ford's 1-liter EcoBoost, now available in the B-Max and Eurofocus, blah, blah, blah. And the 1-liter is available only with a manual transmission. PowerShift models will come with the old 1.6-liter TI VCT engine. Why is that? Gary, do you know why?
Why it'll only come with
the manual? I think it's going to come. If you get the automatic, it automatically goes with the bigger.
Yeah.
It just needs a manual to get out of its own way.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, the PowerShift tranny doesn't do real well as torque drops. It gets real jerky. And that's why they basically said if the car's going to be jerky, let the driver do it with his own clutch.
Okay. And then he'll blame himself.
Yeah.
Or his dog.
So before we check out tonight, Jim, have you driven anything lately that you can share?
Yeah, I drove a new Boxster, both S and Standard, and they were both pretty fabulous, to tell you the truth. They did a good job with it. I drove another car from a major manufacturer I can't talk about yet, and it was a car that when I sat in it, it was genuinely special. It's a large 3.5-liter V6 front-drive car, and it was surprising. Let me see. There's some other cars that were interesting. I got to say, the Tesla at first it knocked my socks off. It was a very impressive automobile. Needs work still, but it's pretty close to there from a development standpoint.
So this will be a production car.
The 3.5-liter car. Yes, it is a production car. Goes on sale before the end of the calendar year, but they haven't let everybody drive it, so they said I can't say anything about, you know, what it is. But it's really nice, and you sit in the interior, and the interior is a special place, quite literally.
Okay.
So I finally had a chance to drive the new Fusion. Have you driven?
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing that surprised me a lot about that car, and maybe this is because I've driven too many cars that now have them, but it doesn't have push-button start. And that surprised me on that car, including the hybrid version.
Yeah.
And it just seemed to me that I mean, it's a small touch, but why they didn't go all the way with that? It's just odd.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. I'm kind of old school, and I still like to put the key in.
Oh, I do too. But I mean, it's just that they're you know, at the forefront of technology in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean,
and then you just look at that white metal key cylinder thing that they've got there.
Yeah, it redefines the mainstream American sedan. I really believe that.
Right.
So yeah, it's an interesting point. What do you think, Jim?
Well, they do have push button start. I drove last weekend. I drove a 1.6 manual transmission EcoBoost, a 2-liter 6-speed auto EcoBoost that had push button start. That was a titanium, and drove a hybrid. And the titanium 2-liter had push button start.
On the Fusion or the Focus? Because I drove a titanium
Focus.
Fusion.
I'm saying Fusion. Excuse me. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry. Fusion.
All right.
Never mind.
We have a couple more comments I'll get to before we wrap it up. Scotty in Cleveland. Hey, man, how are you? Is there a replacement for the XB in the cards? Yes.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
They're just going to keep... They'll call it something else.
Yeah.
And it'll be the XZ or...
Yeah, and Joseph N. says, since the AAH panel just gave Fisker a very bad comparison to a Volt, does the panel think the Volt is a worthwhile buy with the new $10,000 rebate? I have to wonder why the Volt isn't selling better. Is there a problem? What do you think, Jim?
Well, the Volt's one of those cars, for some people it works perfectly, for others it doesn't. The problem is, if you're going to buy one, even with a $10,000 rebate, you got to qualify for a $45,000 Chevrolet.
Yes.
That's the problem, right? To no small degree.
I still think the Volt's a tremendous achievement. The people within GM did that program under severe duress. The company was in a tailspin when they started it, and then it actually went into bankruptcy. And they stayed the course, and I still think it's quite an achievement.
I think that car, if it didn't have the bow tie on it, and it had the Cadillac crest on it, and there would no one would say anything about it costing $45,000, and they would buy that car for $45,000. They would see it for what it is, which is an amazing piece of
engineering,
and yeah. The interior's nice, I mean, it's a four-place vehicle. I mean, you can't put three people in the back seat, but it drives well, looks nice, it's got great IP.
Yeah, my editor, Word Girl, just got one, and it's a fabulous car. It will be interesting, don't you think, Jim, when they bring the Cadillac version out?
Yeah, and the Cadillac version is going to be mechanically... there's going to be some significant changes from between it and the Volt, because they needed to enhance the refinement, and they wanted to do it without deteriorating its electric performance. So there's some stuff they had to do. It's one of the reasons the car's still not out for a little bit less than a year and a half. You know, it could have been faster if they just rebadged and did a reskin, but there's more changes to it than that.
Well,
and it's going to be a better car because of it.
Yeah, I'm glad they did that. I'm glad they waited, because I still think it's quite an arresting design. I think it'll be visually a tremendous statement on the road. So I'm glad they're taking the time to put more in it, do more refinements. I think that'll work out well for them.
It'll probably be less expensive than that SLS, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know what's interesting is that there'll be people that'll buy it just for the way it looks.
Yes.
Like, literally.
Well, and that's the point of success of alternative powertrains, that when people
exactly.
buy the cars because they're cars,
yes.
you know, forget everything else. Is it a good car? Do you like driving the car? Do you feel comfortable in the car?
Yeah.
Not what's under the hood.
Yeah. So, Jim, I'm gratified to know that the Boxster is pretty cool. I think the design changes, I think it looks sensational. So I'm glad it's still a Boxster and it still drives great. Is that what you're
saying? It's a damn nice car. The interesting thing is when you're driving it is they've recontoured the fenders in a way where you don't even think 9/11 when you're looking out of the front of the car.
That's really cool. But that's cool, Jim, because, you know, you run 2953 Analytics, and we're glad you can be on the show in disembodied voice anyway. That's good. And, you know, they don't call you one of the best analysts in the business when you say it's a damn fine car. Reminds me of Major League when Bob Uecker turns to his right-hand guy, and he's all worked up and said, "What do you think about that?" And he just shrugs his shoulders. "Yeah, folks, they don't call him the best color man in the business." But I appreciate you being on the show, Jim. And Gary Vasilash, thank you very much. Again, Jim Hall is from 2953 Analytics. And Gary Vasilash is from Automotive Design and Production. And you can check out Gary's website at autofieldguide.com. You know where to find me, autoextremist.com. I'm also on Twitter, twitter.com/PeterMDLorenzo. And Auto Extremist also on Facebook. So that brings us to the end of another episode. Johnny's eating a very large baguette in Paris as we speak, and good for him. And thank you for watching and listening, and check out the podcast. It's free on iTunes. And that just about does it. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by the 2013 Hyundai Sonata. Learn more at HyundaiSonata.com. Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
Visit our website, AutoLine.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There is all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.